Hey guys. Hello, welcome. My name is Pieros.
And my name is Nikos. And yeah, we're gonna talk about Sadnox. So the idea for today was to have a more practical overview of the network part and the whole observations workflow. And we have a more detailed and high level presentation tomorrow at the Clark Hall about Sadnox if you want to join us. So how many have you heard about Sadnox before? Okay, that's good. Yeah, I mean, the title here pretty much says everything. It's the idea is to create a crowdsourced distributed network of satellite ground stations, and through that crowdsource the very thing of scheduling observations. The project has several parts. It's pretty modular, so we start from the whole workflow starts from the DB, actually, the Sadnox DB, which is a project we started pretty much when we started the whole project. And the idea is that we didn't have there wasn't one holistic approach for satellite data, specifically frequencies, mostly frequencies. So we had some data, public data for satellites from various blogs and websites and so on, but there was not one place to have everything, and in a way that it's also machine readable through an API or something like that. So we created DB, which is all the information there is crowdsourced. So if you have information about satellites, you can go and do suggestions, and there's a big team of volunteers that moderate the suggestions and approve the suggestions. So we have around 200 to 300 satellites with data frequencies, mostly transmitted frequencies, so on. And the reason we also created that is because we needed that in order to create the rest of the Sadnox observation workflow. So we needed that information, especially the frequencies, in order to inform the network part of Sadnox and the ground station, so they know what they actually want to, what frequency they want to listen to satellites. Yeah, this is an example of a satellite. So everything you see here is information that has been crowdsourced by contributors. That specific one, TLADIS, has two transmitters. We have a photo. We have a real-time orbit data for these specific satellites from the TLEs. And db.sadnox.org also has an API, which is public, and everything is in a open data mindset. Everything is Creative Commons. So for instance, I guess you all know GPredict. GPredict actually is using the transmitter's endpoint to, when you choose to fetch data from the network, it actually uses that endpoint to fetch all the transmitters and frequencies for the satellites. So if we go back to the... No, yeah. Yeah, and also another part of DB is that since it's a central place that we use as a single source of truth for satellites, we also started pulling back decoded data for telemetry data for satellites. And this is the statistics page, so here you can see how many different type of transmitters we have, how many satellites. So it's 370 transmitters, 220 satellites, and so on. And you can see how many telemetry data we have per satellite. And this is the contributors that actually have do the observations and push the data. So we have an attribution back to the observer. Yeah, so through the API, yeah, a lot. Yeah, some pagination here. So since we have the API with all that data, that API is also used by Network. Network, it's a website that actually orchestrates the whole observation part of Sadnox. This is the homepage where you can see location of all the stations, all the ground stations we currently have on production that are operating and functional and so on. We have much more that are still on development stage and soon to be on production, hopefully. Yeah, that's the development instance of the network, and you can see that we have many more, even in Slavbot. And I think there's one in Australia too, three in Australia. Yeah. So the network is start to expanding more and more, and the network is using the API to have all the information about the satellites and help the observers or the satellite operators to actually schedule observation to any ground station around the world, not just their ground station but also other people's ground stations. Do you want to showcase some?
So, as we said, is this working? Yes, it is. So, as we said, we have the information on the database, so db.satnox.org, and then the network is actually relying on this information to start doing observations. So I'm going to walk you through a typical process for an observer, like how, if I'm an observer and I have a ground station, how can I go in, schedule, see the results of the satellite, and what can I do with them, right? So let's start by checking the list of the ground stations. And if I click in here and the network responds, pretty busy network today and yesterday.
That too. Yeah,
yeah, that's part of the issue. We had to grow actually our servers considerably over the past couple of months for that reason. Yeah. Did I click it or not?
You
I should have.
You can go to observations. In the meantime, you already have that open, I guess.
Yeah, the observation seems to work fine. Let's click on the stations. Yeah, we can start with the observation. So this is the master list of observations, which is basically just a log of all the different things that happened. And for each observation, what you can see is the unique identifier of the observation, which is a ascending number, and we crossed the 50,000 observations per satellite. Then which satellite was targeted, at which frequency, which encoding we were supposed to listen from that satellite, the time frame, so the start and the end of the observation, any results that were returned, who did the observation and in which station. And basically the color coding that we have here signifies the status of the observation. So if it's blue, it's a scheduled one. It's one that's going to happen in the future. But if I filter out the future observations which don't yet have results, and I say that I don't want the future observations, then the results should be only past ones with the results that they have. It's pretty slow right now. Okay, cool. So here you can see different observations that were returned. The orange ones means that they need vetting, like they need someone to go in and check whether there has been a satellite or not. The green ones have been already vetted as that they successfully had a satellite. And we do this also automatically, not only manually, by checking if there was a decoded payload from the satellite. So we have different kinds of decoding flow graphs on GNU Radio. Right now we support FSK 9600, AFSK 1200, CW, APT for NOAA weather imaging transmissions. So whenever there is a successful payload decoded, then that's automatically green because we know that we actually picked up a satellite. For the other cases, for now we have to go in and check whether the satellite was there, and we're going to see the results and how this looks like. So for example, let's go for this observation. That's a Chinese radio amateur satellite, XW2A. We're supposed to listen it on a 2-meter band. Unfortunately, the Chinese are actually using this part of the band, which for the rest of the world, especially in Europe, is used for repeaters, like local terrestrial repeaters. so much for the ITU coordination, by the way, but yeah. And in some cases we get interferences from local stations, but we should check and see what happened here. Yeah, so I can see more metadata about the observation itself. And then the results are basically three different things. The one is a waterfall, which is a typical FFT against time, color-coded with the noise figure, the signal strength basically on a specific frequency. So on the y-axis, you could see the time. On the x-axis, you can see the frequency. We are Doppler shifting correcting on this one. So whatever you see as something that is going, you know, back and forth, this is basically a terrestrial, you know, ground transmission, because we are already compensating for Doppler. But if you see something which is a straight line, then that should be a satellite. And in this case, you can see it here, like really faint, but still, like we saw that this is an active satellite, right? So I can go ahead and mark this observation as a good one. And that's going to be affecting the status that we have of the satellite. And we have some, basically, if you click on the satellite, you can see the success rate of the satellite for previous observations and, you know, guess whether it's going to be successful on a next pass. Also, depending on which station has heard it, which antennas, and, you know, those kind of things. So the one part of the result which we always get is a waterfall, right? And that's pretty straightforward, and it's encoding agnostic. Like, we don't care about the encoding itself. And then we have the audio part of the transmission. And for this, we are decoding audio, demodulating audio, basically, based on our best guess for the encoding itself. So if it's a CW, it goes through a narrow filter and tries to find, like, the CW transmission in there. If it's a FSK transmission, then it's a wider FM audio decoding, and we supply those downloadable for people, so that if someone wants to do their own analysis and decode them themselves, they can download the audio and do that themselves. And in case something was picked up, you would see that here on data. So let's try to find an observation that this also has decoded data and see how this went. Yes.
That's only one station every measurement.
Concurrently, you mean?
No, like tracing a satellite over several stations.
Yeah, right now we don't have a way to do a single observation for multiple ground stations, if that's what you're asking. Yeah, so right now we don't do that. It's like one per station. Because, well, there are a couple of reasons. The one is that, well, software related one, which is much more difficult, and we need to do that. That's the obvious one. But it's also like the density of the network right now would not be enough to have concurrent passes. It would have to be really specific, like if it goes from UK to Greece, that we have multiple stations, yes, and then within US, like Eastern and Western, yes. But other parts of the world would be, you know, missing, basically. So again, if I filter out the future ones and go to something which is more successful in terms of decoding. Okay. Yeah, so that must be much nicer. So this is a English ground station. This is a Greek observer, and that's Bagsat-1, a satellite that has a FSK 9600 AX25 beacon. And you can see the beacons clearly on the waterfall. And if you click on the data, then you can see the raw hex payloads that we got from that satellite, right? And the concept of the network is to be agnostic of the payload internals. So we just do the demodulation, and then we end up with the raw bytes itself. And then we push everything that we have on db.satnox.org, where it sits with the other millions of packets. And then the next project for us would be on db.satnox.org to go in a satellite and see things that are decoded. So for example, for a telemetry transmission like this, each satellite pretty much uses their own, you know, encoding scheme on top of AX25. So you would see here that probably the fourth byte here would be the temperature, and the 16th byte would be the you know, magnetometer reading on something, but this is specific to the satellite itself, right? And we figured that we should stay on the network side of things. We should stay on the raw type of data and then feed it on a central place that is fed with other payload feeds and have the satellite teams work with us and do the decoding so that we can see the, you know, like graphs and all the different data per satellite, which is a much more involved work and it's super specific to its satellite. So we would rather stay, you know, as agnostic as possible on the network side of things. So yeah, those would be the transmissions. And they also have a timestamp over there for its transmission, which is pretty useful if you want to do things like basically graphs of where the data was picked up per ground station. So one thing that we did recently, I think it's worth showing. Let me do that here. Oops. Give me a sec. Yeah, so this one. So what this is one of our ground stations, and all the different dots that you can see here are basically decoded payloads. And what we did here was the reverse way around, because we know the timestamp and we know the Keplerian elements, like the orbital data for the satellite itself and the position of the ground station. We could extrapolate where exactly this payload was decoded, basically. And then if we plot those, we can see where the successes are happening per ground station. So this is basically giving us a sense of, you know, where the station is working correctly. And this is due to, obviously, you know, like obstacles on the horizon or problems with tracking, or, you know, like if you have a building next to you or something is happening on one side or another. This specific ground station actually has two really large buildings here and here. So we can clearly see that it's not going to be decoding any packets on that. And we're going to be automating that also on the network so that the observers know where they should, you know, get some transmissions. So, yeah, let's walk through the life of an observer. So first thing you do is basically you come to the available ground stations. So this is the ground stations list, and with green you can see the ground stations that are available right now for observations. And how we know that is that basically each ground station has its own client code, which is a Python instrumentation that we have running locally, and it's constantly pinging the network, right? So it's a kind of like a pool type of architecture, because we couldn't push to the clients unless there was a network. You know, you have to bypass NATs and everything. So we figured, you know, that the client should always pull from the network. So whenever the client checks, if do I have a job? Do I have a job? Right, from the network, then we make sure that we note it so that we know it's online and when was the last time that it checked with us. So those are the different ground stations. You can see the location of the ground stations, how many things they had in total, how many observations they had in total in the past, and what has been the success rate for those observations, and then whether they have future observations scheduled on them. So if you are an observer and you see something like for the next day, like this 23 ground station actually has 50 observations scheduled, you know it's pretty full, like you're not going to get any windows, you know, in there. And then what kind of antennas and who's the owner of the ground station. So let's try to find a ground station which is empty, let's say the Hikerspace one. That's our first ground station on top of the Hikerspace in Athens, where it all started. And you can see more information about the ground station, the location of it, like a photo of the actual setup. And then you're waiting for the past predictions to be loaded from the network. And once the past predictions...
Oh, the
last scene, like when it was the last time that it actually pinged the network so that you know it's alive, right? So this is a timeline of all the different satellites that are going to be passing above this ground station. And the way it works is that you have the name of the satellite, the success rate of the satellite, so that you know whether it's been successful in the past or not. So, for example, for OSCAR 7, which is a super old radio amateur satellite, but it also has a shortwave transponder on it, which is Interesting. We've been almost 50-50, more on the, you know, failed side. So I'm not gonna favor it unless I actually wanted to do an observation and check if it's available again. Then the time frame, you know, when it starts crossing the horizon and then when it sets. That's the data for the pass itself. So here would be the azimuth of rise. That would be the max elevation, and that's going to be the azimuth for set, like when it, where it crosses the horizon again. A polar plot, so you can, you know, visually quickly see how the pass satellite is going to be operating, and then a button to schedule this observation. So let's try to find one observation that it's going to be producing some interesting results. So okay, here I have ITOPSAT. 41 degrees, but I know that this ground station is actually cool on 41 degrees in these azimuths. And if I click on schedule, then a new window opens. And in here, the satellite itself is pre-selected. The time frame is pre-selected because it's based on the predictions that we did on the ground station. And in here, I can choose different transmitters. So different satellites have multiple transmitters, and this information is coming from db.satnox.org, basically. And I can check, you know, the frequency that it's going to be using and the encodings and everything. I'm going to be using the drifted one because we've seen that many times, actually most of the times, the satellites have an advertised frequency, and then when they go up in space, the oscillator drifts, and you know, there are other thermal events or something happens and they drift slightly, you know, to the left or right. Well, basically through observations. So we start the observations and then we adjust from based on what we see. It's going to be an interesting project to do that automatically, actually. Like try to find, you know, what's the drift and then submit it on the database. So in this case, I'm going to use this third one. I can also check when was the last time that the two-line element, like the orbital information for the satellite, was issued. So this was issued a day and an hour ago, which is not that long ago. Like the TLEs don't change that much within a day. So it's, you know, like recent enough. And if I do the calculation, then it's going to say that Hackerspace 1 is available throughout this time. So do you want to schedule this, like actually commit on doing that? And then I click on schedule. And that becomes a pending scheduled observation. And I wait here for the results to come back. It's the question was whether it's first serve, first come. Yes, it is. So the first that comes, it's going to be the one that does that. There are cases that you can override things. So basically, we're working right now on a permission model so that the ground station owners have more priority over their own ground station than others, and they can override observations. And we also have a group of moderators, which is basically people that can override pretty much everything. They can delete observations, and of course, in collaboration and communication with ground station owners. And that happens a lot only in cases that we have new satellites, right? So when we're hunting new satellites, we have a new launch from ISS or a new rocket launch or something, and we are, you know, like really trying to see whether the satellite worked, whether the frequency is correct, you know, whether, well, it worked by itself is, you know, huge enough for the teams of the satellites, right? So in this case, we just make sure that everyone knows that we're going to be, you know, prioritizing those, and there's sort of a operation center coming in an IRC channel and trying to coordinate the observations. Who has the first pass, who's going to do the second, and those kind of things. Yeah, we're not going to be waiting now. This is UTC time. That's 2 hours ahead of us right now. So yeah, in 2 hours' time, if you come back here, you're going to see the result. And because it's ITOPSAT and on Hackerspace, it's going to be pretty successful, actually. And we're going to see the waterfall, unless the satellite fails by that time. Highly doubt it. So if I'm an observer, this is the way that I go through and do, you know, all sorts of scheduling, basically. And then every, you know, day or so, or whenever I have time, I would come back to the observations and check for things that need vetting, right? So if I click on, I don't want the future ones. Come on. Yeah, let's go through the different colors here. So those are the future ones. Those are the good ones that we vetted or automatically vetted that the actual satellite was heard. The red ones are the ones that the satellite was not heard, so probably something wrong with the satellite. The orange ones are the ones that need vetting, that we need to vote on. And then we have the black ones, which are the failed ones. And this is the difference between the black and the red is that on red, the satellite failed. On black, the client, the ground station itself failed. And we know that if it's not returning any results, or if it's like super noisy waterfall and there's something wrong with the coaxial cable or something wrong with the antenna, and we just mark them as failed so that, you know, the ground station owners know that there's something wrong with the station itself rather than the satellite, right? Like, those are two completely different things. So if I go in here, I would search for different things that are basically orange observations, and opening them up, I will try to see, well, clearly there is a satellite here, so this should be marked as good. So I'm marking it as good. Let's check another one. Okay, that's an interesting, again, Chinese satellite, XW2C, and you can see, again, this is a part of the local transponders, like the local repeaters band in US and Europe, and you can see some interference from those. And XW satellites also have multiple different transmitters really close to another. So there is a CW beacon that is happening on the center, and then you have a whole part of the spectrum which is dedicated for transponding. So basically a repeater in space, like you transport up, like you're uplink something and then it, you know, transport this back. That's why you can see slight movements in here. This is basically people trying to do manually Doppler shifting and keeping themselves within the satellite itself. This is a linear transponder with a quite wide range, so that wherever you actually uplink in there, the satellite does the same thing on a different band. And then you'd have other transmissions, like data transmissions from the satellite, or local noise. I think that this is actually local noise rather than transmission from the satellite itself. Yeah, this is clearly a satellite, so I'm going to mark it as good. And then another one. Yeah, so this, you can faintly see the satellite beacons here. And it's useful to get an eye for those kind of things, basically by checking what kind of transmissions are you waiting for it to see. If it was CW, you'd wait to see like a clear line, like intermittent line, right? BPSKs, especially like narrow BPSKs, is just, you know, those kind of small lines that you see here. The other lines that are going all the way around is basically local interference noise. And that might not be, in this case, those are probably from the power supply itself. So it's a EMI from the power supply. Antenna type of interferences from other stations or beacons are visible by being intermittent. So you would not see them as continuous as EMI from a power supply, right? So in this case, this ground station, which is in southern Greece, should check their power supply and try to, you know, eliminate the noise issue. Again, though, this is a good one because we can clearly see that the satellite was active. So yeah, that's the life of an observer. Once this, we are right now constantly adding new, well, ground stations, obviously, like trying to expand as much as possible. But the most crucial thing for us is to expand the decoders on GNU Radio. So if any of you, like, is, you know, active on GNU Radio coding, that's a tremendous amount of opportunity in all the different things that we have. And the test bed that we use is basically all our different ground stations. So it's easy for us to push new flow graphs and then have the clients actually test the results of those flow graphs on GNU Radio and get the results back, so that we can expand and target more encodings, especially BPSKs, GMSKs. Those are the things that we haven't done yet. We are pretty okay on FSK and CW and APT. I should show some APT here because it's interesting. Let's go through here. Try to find a weather satellite. Some NOAA ones would be nice. Those are the US amateur, meteorological satellites. So if I go in here and then here, It's going to be a faint one. You can see the APT transmission for those of you that recognize it. And that's not going to be, you know, perfect, but still you can see the decoding of the weather image automatically in here. In other cases, like this one, much nicer. Yeah, and here you can see a decoding of the weather satellite. I think that that's England. Yeah, this station is on Denmark, so that's probably Northern Europe. But with so much clouds, you know, it's not always easy to detect what you're seeing. Yeah, that's the flow basically. Nikos, you wanna add anything to the flow?
No, I guess also there's the option to, I don't know if you want to show it from the observation point of view, you can choose a satellite and then see which ground stations are available.
So yeah, the other way around, instead of going through a ground station and see what satellites are from the ground station, you can go from a satellite and see where it's available in which ground stations. So if I click here on new observation, I can select, let's say, the UK Cube 1. On this frequency, that's fine. For the next, let's say, hour or so, or a couple of hours. And if I click on calculate, yeah, it's going to tell me that those different ground stations have those available windows of observations. And I can click on schedule and schedule all of them at the same time. Although this is not necessarily advisable, especially because there are things like, you know, those kind of things. We're working on a solution to deselect, you know, just click on, yes, I want this, this, and that. Just schedule them.
Yeah. At the moment, we calculate the overlaps and we exclude overlapped observation window. So, for instance, you can see that's actually a bug. It shouldn't be here, but you see that these two stations have no observation windows because they have overlapped with other observations already. So, they shouldn't even be there.
And that's pretty useful for post-LEOP, like post-launch operations, so that we can quickly check for all the network for the next day. You know, who's going to be available to do what. And then quickly, you know, schedule them in bulk.
Yeah. So, any questions so far?
I have more. So, what is your target audience? I mean, who's going to observe? I see everybody can observe now, right?
Well, the question is who is the target audience and if anybody can observe. So I'm going to start with the latter part, which is the who can observe here. Basically, the permission model that we have right now is that in order to get access to the network, you can create an account, that's fine. But unless you have a ground station, you are not able to schedule on other ground stations. And the concept there is an incentive to grow the network. We're not charging, obviously, for anything. We're not, like, this is a non-profit volunteer-run operation, right? But the concept would be that we can invite and incentivize more people to have ground stations, and then you get access to the whole network, like the others are going to get access to your ground station. So that's the permission. Then regarding the audience itself, I would say we started with radio amateurs, like, because, well, they have the antennas, they have some rotators, they know their way around things, right? But quickly, especially as we moved, initially we were also supporting the hardware radios. So audio, you know, output from old, you know, hardware actual radios. And then it was quickly, you know, obvious that SDR is the way to go for many different reasons. So when we moved to the SDR side of things, then more and more people that are doing things like SDR hacking, not necessarily on radio amateurs, not even satellites, right? It was more nice for them to get to work with something which is GNU radio specific, so expanding more outside the radio amateur type of typical crowd. And then a super specific group that is using the Satnox network is the actual satellite operators. So a university team that is putting up a CubeSat, they're adding a ground station on the network and they're using other, you know, ground stations around the world. But this is specific to the satellite itself, right? Any? Yeah, go ahead.
I've seen there are something like 280 satellites in your database. I think there are more than 20,000, or I don't know. I mean, it's UX10. But is there a way to crawl them somehow? Just from, I mean, it would be hard to find by hand every 20,000 of the satellites.
Yeah, so. Okay, numbers and satellites. Okay, cool. So we have 220 satellites that we were able to track, right? And the operational satellites out there are not 20,000. Actually, there are 6,000. Yeah, there are many debris and, you know, decommissioned satellites and everything else. So what's the difference between the 200 that we track and the 6,000 that are out there, right? Well, a considerable amount of the 6,000, it's never going to publish their frequencies. We're talking about, you know, even scientific ones that are not open to the public, or military ones, or, you know, things that are not documented or are old and everything else. And that might be actually, you know, almost half of those, like really many of them. Then even that, how you go from 200 to 3,000, if you say that it's half, basically the question is a question of crowdsourcing. Like, we are constantly reaching out to as many teams as possible, trying to provide them with, provide us with their frequencies so we can use them. And there are two restrictions there. The one is which bands they're using. Many of them are not using radio amateur bands, which are open for if you have an amateur license. Most CubeSats do. That's why, you know, most of the satellites that we track are CubeSats. But many of them, so for example, let's take the Sentinel meteorological Earth observing satellites from the European Space Agency. So it's a bunch of them right now up, like 10 of them or something, in various different phases. And the frequencies they use for downlinking and everything else, like, even though we know them, we don't know what encoding they use necessarily. They change it all the time. The packet framing is not open. Like, even if you know the frequency and you can see the carrier, and even if you have the antennas and the equipment to receive them, because those, most of them are actually in 5Gs and 10Gs and, you know, X-band and KA, KU band. And it's totally possible to do that with the SatNOX in terms of instrumentation, like the software and everything else. But the problem would be that you wouldn't know what to do with the data in any case. Like, the framing that they have and everything else, like, is probably either encoded or completely undocumented. And they're not willing to actually share this kind of thing. And this goes back to the, you know, we need as much help as possible to try to make these groups pressured enough to actually publish the results of their satellites, especially if it's publicly funded satellites, like ESA satellites for Earth observing. You know, we, assuming that we are all from Europe, we paid for those, right? And there's also a political and ethical, you know, issue about sending something up, not knowing the frequency, not knowing how it's used, keeping them things, you know, cloud source. Like, I would be okay even by documenting them, let alone having open source code to actually decode them. That's
yeah.
And then that's that happens a lot, unfortunately. Yeah, that's true, actually. So whenever in many jurisdictions, even within Europe too, reception of specific signals outside your license, like if you are a radio amateur, or outside ISM bands, which, well, we can all use for reception, then that's illegal by itself. So that's also a local issue that we're working together with the ground stations locally. Yeah, there's no easy way around it, basically, unless, you know, there is a major move which not only talks about satellites, but generally about RF RF spectrum, and trying to harmonize the legislation around that, so that we can at least, you know, listen to things, let alone transmit on different bands.
So leaving the modulation and coding aside, how much communication is actually encrypted on top, so that even if you manage to decode, demodulate the data, you're getting rubbish because it's encrypted? How much you see of this?
Yeah, so anecdotally, we don't have hard stats from that, right? But everything that uses radio amateur bands, in theory, is obliged to be open and not encrypted. That's due to global radio amateur legislation. I mean, thankfully, that's the case. Some people are actually violating this, and on top of radio amateur bands, they're transmitting encrypted content. There's a process to actually file appeal to ITU about this, but there's little you can do if you put up the satellite, you know, and it's already up there, and they're going to be saying, well, it's up there, go and get it, right? The problem arises, sorry for the tangent, but I want to address this. The problem arises whenever you try to assign, we actually flew a satellite ourselves. It's up there, and we've been through the process. So we know the process of, you know, ITU filing for a frequency and get the assignment and everything else. If you see the way that you get your frequency assigned, it's rubbish. Like, it's basically you say what type of satellite you're going to be flying, around which frequency you would want to use, and there's going to be negotiation around that. But they're not asking you about anything else. They ask you for the encoding, that's fine. But then they don't tell you that it should be open, and it should be, and they're not verified. Whenever you deliver your satellite, we delivered the satellite in the checkout we did on Netherlands, right? And when we delivered the satellite, no one checked that we actually used this frequency or used this encoding or this is decodable. They couldn't, like, I could have done anything I wanted. It would still go in space, and then I would be, well, it's in space. Go figure, right? And people actually do that. Like, yeah, they do that. Like, and that's bad. So that's the one side of thing. Then for the other side, which is if it's outside the radio amateur, actually the vast majority, yeah, people are excited about satellites. That's nice. So the vast majority of the satellites that are operating outside the radio amateur transmissions are actually using encrypted communications. So, and it can be scrambled communications, but it can be actual encrypted, communications. So, yeah, the scrambling is fine as long as you know the polynym and everything else to descramble it, right? But the encryption is, off the case. And of course, you have to consider many satellites that are used for, DVBS transmissions, like a geosynchronous audio-visual type of transmissions that we have, digital transmissions. All of them are. Well, the majority of them are encrypted right now on many different levels, not only on the network level, on the application level of the transmission and everything else. So. Yeah, you no chance of seeing, unless it actually shows up or you know what you're looking for. You have no way, but this is the same thing with terrestrial transmissions, right? So different legislations have different kind of rules around the world about where you can listen, right? There is no way around it. The actuality of the situation is that as long as you're receiving, there is a plausible deniability about who received what from where, because you're receiving, right? This is not the legal way to go about it, obviously, but this is what actually happens. Not only for satellite, signal interception, but also for terrestrial interception. You're listening. There's no way for someone to know whether you're listening or not. The weird thing is that for our own transmissions, this is actually online with an API and everything. So if someone wants to know who is listening to what, that's actually up there, and it's pretty easy. So we have to be much more careful to not jeopardize the operation and put people at risk on their own jurisdictions. So, and there is a way to do that, actually. So whenever you say which antenna you have, and that's only selectable by the ground station owner. So the antenna that you input, right here, you say what type of antenna, which band, okay, and then you specify a frequency range. So if that's legal in your country, you should be fine. Like, the network cannot override this this frequency. So I cannot say that Hikerspace GR ground station should listen to 148 or 156, right? Because that's out of range in any case. So yeah, at least that's a bare minimum, you know, restriction so that we can be legal on different countries and not put people at risk. Not right now, mainly because our API is open. We see some heavy traffic on an API. We would like to check, you know, we don't want to check logs for IPs and things like that. That's bad practice for privacy reasons. But if we see excessive load on the API, you know, I think that we should crack down what's happening.
So, that you have a satellite that you discovered that was transmitting data that you were not expecting?
Well, the question is that if we've seen satellites that are transmitting things that we were not expecting. The question is yes, but not why you might think. Most of the times, unfortunately, what happens is this. There is a university team that is putting up a CubeSat. Cool. The project goes on for 5 or 6 years. Different people come and go in the project. Like typical academic research project, right? Like we almost all have been there, and we wish we'd never been there, but that's a different story. That's a story for tomorrow. Like, we're going to be giving a talk about the satellite, and it has parts of it. So basically, people come and go. Documentation, you know, becomes obsolete. You know, things are, you know, not published well. At the end of the day, somehow you manage, like, as a team to deliver the satellite. Those are different people from the people that started it, and different people from the people that wrote the documentation. Like, you know, all sorts of people. And what we end up having is that the documentation was about a different part of a project that is no longer relevant, and the satellite that goes up, you know, is published on a blog of a person, of the researcher, on the PhD student that actually did that, probably in a paper somewhere, right? And that's the majority and the norm for the satellites that we've seen. That's why one of the driving reasons of creating db.chatnox.org, like a crowdsourced, you know, centralized approach of where the frequencies are, is due to this, because we were, when we started the network, we were doing that manually. We were going through blogs of people, trying to find information about the frequency. Most of them were wrong. So yes, many times we find things that we didn't expect, but this is not because they planned it, but this is because the practice was bad. So that's the...
Do you get any sponsors or any support from universities or...
Yeah, so the question is about sponsors and support of the university. So let me clarify the scheme of Satnox. So Satnox is a project of the Libre Space Foundation. So we have a non-profit foundation that is supporting this. We actually created the Libre Space Foundation in order to support Satnox, like the other way around. Yeah. But we also do other things now, right? So Libre Space Foundation has its own funds, like through targeted development, you know, like research type of grants and those kind of things, and we funnel them to Satnox. The support that we're getting specifically, like directly for Satnox, most of the time is actually a ground station itself. So for example, the Tromsø University in Oslo, like they had a ground station, a group of people wanted to put it on Satnox, they put it on Satnox, right? I consider this considerable support, but this is the most of the times like what we're getting. So yeah. And I think we are on time.
Ah, yeah.
Nikos, any final remarks?
No, I mean, if you want to know, as I said in the beginning, the project is pretty modular, so we didn't talk about other stuff of the project, like the ground station itself, the hardware parts, the client part, and so on. So if you want to hear about that, we have a talk tomorrow at the Clark room, and for the satellite too, there's back-to-back talks. So you can join us there, and you can find us on the table right next to this stage. Okay, thank you.